Welcome to the MS News Today podcast. I'm your host, Jen Powell, and I also have secondary progressive multiple sclerosis. I am a columnist with MS News Today at multiplesclerosisnewstoday.com. Thank you all for listening to this podcast. Let me invite you to join our MS forums. We have over 1,000 active members discussing common themes and sharing their experience on living with multiple sclerosis. Please consider joining. You can find the link to the MS News Today forums in this episode's description. Today, we're welcoming back Dr. Tim Coetzee. Dr. Tim Coetzee serves on the National MS Society's Chief Advocacy Services and Science Officer. In this role, he leads the organization's efforts to drive public policy, implement impactful and sustainable programs and services for people with MS, and fund innovative MS research around the world. Tim is a member of the Society's CEO Leadership Team, serves on the Scientific Steering Committee of the International Progressive MS Alliance, and is the co-chair of the National Academy of Medicine's Forum on Regenerative Medicine. Prior to joining the Society, Tim was a faculty member at the University of Connecticut Health Center, where he conducted MS research and focused in the area of myelin and myelin repair. Tim received his PhD in molecular biology from Albany Medical College and followed that with a fellowship training at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. His work in MS research was launched with a fellowship from the National MS Society. Dr. Coetzee, welcome.
Well, it's great to be with you, Jen, and why don't we just dispense with the doctor part and just make it first name basis, which would be great.
I like that, Tim, because I tried not to really hurt your last name. You deserve respect. I hope I got a little bit of it right.
It was just fine. Thank you.
It's so wonderful to have you back. As many of you know, Tim has been here before and is part of the MS Society, which really was my first call when I was diagnosed. And I credit to giving me directions. So thank you for being a part of that amazing organization.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's been a joy to work at the organization. It's great to be with your audience. We have so much to talk about.
Thank you, Doctor. Tim. I think a lot of people hear your role at the society and don't quite understand how that translates. Can you explain in the human terms what that means?
certainly. Yeah, it's a mouthful of a title. I think the way I would describe it for your listeners is that we have a mission of, being focused on curing MS while empowering people affected by MS to live their best lives. And my role as one of the senior leaders of the organization is to ensure that we deliver on that mission. And it involves, really providing leadership to our teams that focus on advocating for better and higher quality healthcare for people affected by MS and making sure we have insurance policies and regulations that make sense for people affected by MS. I have the responsibility of leading a team that is, our MS Navigator team, as we call it, which is there to support people across their MS journey. As you note, I'm also a scientist originally, and so part of my portfolio is also our research team, our scientific programs, and delivering on our pursuit of a cure, both through the science that we fund here in the United States, but also internationally, through the International Progressive MS Alliance and some of the other work that I do internationally with ECTRIMS and other organizations. My role is to integrate all of those. Each of them has a leader, but my role is to serve as an integrator and to ensure that, we keep people focused on our mission, which is to cure MS and empower people affected to live powerfully.
I love that because, in essence, you're really bringing the research, the people, the initiatives, and the legislation and everything together and how that can all contribute toward our cure.
Exactly. It all works together. I mean, finding a cure for MS means focusing on the science to get the cure, but also at the same time, people live with MS while we are looking to find a cure, and we need to be here for people living with the disease while we also work to find a cure for the disease.
That resonates powerfully for me, and I'm sure many listeners, as I have progressive MS, secondary progressive, and a lot of new symptomatology, even in the last year. And how do we live with MS while we find a cure? That is wonderful that you are in tune to that, because we're all trying to live our lives with this disease. And I think that can be tricky sometimes.
Indeed, indeed.
As I sit here and try and stutter out words I used to come naturally to me. you are dedicated to scientific research, and you know that was your forte. And how this research translates to people can often be difficult for the everyday person. You know, hearing about a disease-modifying therapy or remyelinization. If someone really wants to better understand how that research translates, where can they look for that?
Sure. So obviously, again, part of it is, you know, certainly visit our website, and there's lots of content on our website. The great work that our mutual friend John Strum does with the Real Talk MS podcast, where he translates some of that great science into very accessible content. We really are proud to partner with John on bringing some of that science to people. So maybe I could take a spin at your question to sort of talk a little bit about sort of the research enterprise and what we fund, and how, you know, there is a continuum of research. So my story is, as you noted, I was an MS researcher, as my team likes to remind me. But you know, I started in endocrinology. My early work was focused on myelin repair and understanding how myelin gets built, so that you can actually then figure out how to repair it in a person. And so my research was very kind of fundamental in the laboratory, not so much involving people. But we have a great example actually in the work in myelin repair field of how that can really go from very basic to clinical trials. A few years ago, we actually gave a grant to a researcher at the University of California, San Francisco, one of the Barancic Prize for Innovation in MS Research. Jonah, like myself, was really interested in understanding, you know, how do oligodendrocytes put myelin around a nerve cell? It's a very important question, but because it's hard to sort of, you know, get inside the brain, you can't actually see that in real time. You know, you want to be able to tease out what are the things you need in order to build myelin. And so Jonah came to us with this, what at the time sounded like a crazy idea, which was, you know, can I get oligodendrocytes, the cells that make myelin, to put myelin around a fiberglass tube, and then in the laboratory, and so that the fiberglass tube mimicked a nerve cell. And at the time, people were like, you know, this is just so, see, it's important, right? You would be able to sort of study it, really work at it in a very elegant way that you can do when you can do stuff in the laboratory. You can ask lots of questions, but people were like, well, will that lead to anything? Well, the reality was Jonah learned a lot, but then that innovation of trying to get form myelin around fiberglass led to him basically pioneering an invention that then allowed him and collaborators to test a bunch of treatments for their potential to promote myelin repair. And now, just a few years since then, there's actually clinical trials going on in people using, you know, of myelin repair agents that could be, you know, next generation myelin repair agents. They're in a phase two clinical trial being conducted by a company called Continuum Therapeutics based in California. And I can draw a straight line from that clinical trial all the way back to that grant that we gave him, I think in 2008, to answer the question, can you get an oligodendrocyte to myelinate fiberglass tubes? And that's sort of how, you know, sometimes the science is not as obvious, and it then can lead all the way to something like that in people. But, you know, there are other, you know, when we think about science at the National MS Society, there's also a lot of other aspects. So what your audience should know is that, yes, we fund very basic work like, you know, Jonah did, that can lead to clinical trials. We fund the next generation of scientists like me a long time ago and others. We've actually launched the career of over, now I think it's 1,200 researchers, many of whom have gone on to discover important treatments. And so, one of the things we know is that if you get a fellowship from the MS Society, odds are good that in 10 years you're still going to be working in MS, in 20 years you're still going to be working in MS. So we are creating that next generation, but we also fund other kinds of research, such as many people with MS, falling, worry about falling with MS. And so we've actually invested in research to understand what might cause a fall, and then come up with strategies that rehab professionals can use to help prevent falls. We've invested in research to look into fatigue and to cognition and all those other dimensions of MS. And so, our philosophy, my philosophy is you need to take a holistic approach to the problem and not just sort of focus on one aspect of it. So that's how, when we talk about improving the lives of people with MS, we want better treatments, but we also want to have a better quality of life. And quality of life research is just as important as the research getting at myelin repair strategies. We try to take a balanced approach to it, but that's just a couple of real world examples for you.
But thank you for illustrating that first about Jonah, because now we do have those phase two clinical trials about myelin repair. And I'm nerding out over here because that stuff excites me, right? Because this is the stuff is this, and having MS and loving science is why I love being in this field, because there's so much wealth of possibility in what the MS Society does, is it provides a platform for many of these things to be done.
Indeed, indeed. That's
Speaking of
why I
Johnstown,
love working at this organization.
absolutely. And I've been involved with the organization just fundraising for Walk MS since I was diagnosed 14 years ago. And as a small, tiny, tiny part of it makes me proud. I want to just give a shout out to John Strum. Not that he needs it, but he is an amazing husband. He's a widower. His wife Jean, who passed of MS, he has dedicated his life to informing others through his podcast, which is Talk MS. And I really urge people to go take a listen, follow, and listen on in his podcast. He was my very first guest, and I admire who he is and what he's dedicated his life toward.
Yeah, he's an awesome friend. He is an I can't I'll see him this week actually at the ACTRIMS conference, and I can't wait to see him.
Well, give him a hug from Jen. I won't be down there in North Florida this
I
time,
sure
but
will.
next time, thank you. There are so many MS developments. It's really hard to figure out, like from biomarkers to myelin repair. But what excites you now? I know there's different themes and different avenues, but is it more on how to treat an individual or like biomarkers? What do you see as
That's a
like my
great
word
question.
exciting?
It's a tricky question, because I could go on for hours, but we don't have hours. But I think so. A couple things, just sort of at the immediate, sort of stating the obvious. I think there's a lot of interest. I'm excited by some of the new treatments that are being tested, the BTK inhibitors, which are, I know in testing for both relapsing and progressive MS. Better, more targeted ways at getting at B cells. Those are terrific. There is this new treatment, frexalimab, that just had some positive results that were reported in the New England Journal of Medicine, which also excites me because what it's opening up is another pathway of perhaps targeting the immune system and relapsing MS, potentially progressive MS. And so having this kind of range of options, I think, is important, because what I'm hopeful for is that we will soon get to a place where there's a more what we call precision medicine approach to managing MS, where, based on a person's profile, you could then have one or two treatments that are tailored to their particular profile, and then perhaps get the kind of precision and that we're seeing in other diseases, like some cancers, for example, that have incredibly precise treatment strategies. I'm excited also about some of the science that was reported last year to ACTRIMS, where they've been able to identify that we now may have a genetic marker for the disease severity, and which is, I think, a really important milestone in our understanding the genetics of MS. We've known for a long time that there's a number of genetic markers that could contribute to a person having a risk of MS, that could give you sort of interests about, why some individuals might have propensity to develop the disease versus others. But what we've not had is the ability to say, does a person's genetic makeup also give us the ability to predict about their disease course? We haven't had that. And finally, now, as a result again of a massive collaboration of the scientific community, and not just the scientists collaborating, but thousands of people living with MS donating their genetic material, because this wouldn't be possible without the, I think, the nearly 30,000 people who donated their own genetic material to be part of the study. We have the first set of insights, and we found first a gene for the severity of MS that predicts that if individuals have it, they will have a more aggressive disease course relative to other people. That hasn't quite translated yet into the doctor will look at you, do the screening, and say, let's try this treatment or that treatment. We're not there yet. But in order to get to that future, you got to start somewhere. And so this is the first start, and I anticipate there'll be more coming along. So I'm excited about that. I think an important development has also been this, what I'm just going to call the unmasking of the fact that progression and progression can happen without any relapses. It's called PIRA by the fancy science term. Your audience might also know it by another term that I don't love, called smoldering MS, which I don't love that concept of smoldering. But the idea that there are other facets of MS that, even if you don't have relapses, are still present and contributing to progression. And I heard it actually rather, nicely described by another colleague, who said that our ability to stop relapses with the current disease-modifying treatments has unmasked this aspect of MS that was probably there from the beginning, but we just couldn't see it because relapses were so damaging, they covered up what was going on. But it gets to the question that I'm sure you've had conversations with other people with MS, like I've had, where let's say I haven't had a relapse in 10 years, but I know I'm not the same person I was 10 years ago. So something else is going on with the disease. And that is, I would say, a very important emerging area that we have to tackle as a community, because that progression, we have to find ways to stop it.
You just
And I think
described
that's an
me.
important scientific.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
You just described me, smoldering MS. I was talking to Dr. Antonava, and we were talking about smoldering MS in my own doctor that smoldering MS in the absence of relapses, why did I get to this progressive state? And suddenly, with the absence of any physiological lesions on my MRI, how did I suddenly get to now where there are multiple highlighted regions of disability and permanent disability? So that's a huge, huge area of intrigue.
It is. And I think from a scientific and clinical standpoint, there's a couple things we need to do. One is we've got to figure out what's the biology that's underlying that and target it. And it's telling us that I think that there's aspects of damage to nerves that go beyond the immune system. It also means that we need to focus in on how do we ensure that individuals live powerfully with progression into PIRA, smoldering MS, whichever it is. Whatever term we use, we got to arrive at a term. I don't love any of the terms that are out there, but I think that it is another emerging area of science. The other aspect that we're also getting at, which is part of the work that I do with an international committee that we're tackling, is the element of people are getting older with MS. And when I started the MS Society, no one talked about sort of like, well, what would old age with MS look like? Well, now we actually have, I was looking at some of the data. There's a number of people who are on Medicare getting a disease-modifying treatment. There's a couple hundred thousand people over the age of 65 getting a DMT. And so, the obviously the body changes as you get older. And so understanding, how for example, the immune system changes over time in an older individual. Do they need to keep taking that DMT? Does what happens to the brain as people get older in MS? Some of the age-related things of, somebody might walk slower when they go to see their neurologist, but they might walk slower just because they're older, not because their MS has contributed to them being older, or it might be a combination of both. We don't know the answer to those questions. And one of the things that I was not so aware of is we're also starting to see more and more people diagnosed over the age of 50, which just surprised me. But apparently, you know, I talked to colleagues, you know, that people go to, they go see what people, they're having sometimes cognitive challenges, and they think that they're having Alzheimer's. It turns out they have MS when they do an MRI. And we don't actually have a lot of insight as to what the later onset MS looks like and what it would mean to treat later onset. That would be people over the age of 50 and the like. But those are all, you know, I think big important areas that we're starting to focus on as a scientific community.
I think I need to have you here for half a day now. So forget the half hour. I think we're on.
Well, I can come back. You know how to reach me. I'm always happy to come back.
Unfortunately for you, I do. So I'm as someone who will be 55 in 2 weeks, I also notice the disease manifestation changes. And my doctor and I have revisited my DMT and have changed it based on changes, not only, and I encourage people to have this dialogue with their physician, just to get a blood panel, see how you're doing, have your tests updated, be very cognizant of having this dialogue with your healthcare team. One other area of interest to me is, you know, I'm very intrigued by DEI and how we can serve underserved privileges and underserved communities, and how we can include representation. And I know this kind of goes, I was only thinking of this because at 55, I am no longer eligible for a clinical trial. And I am definitely not underserved or underprivileged. But I do feel like there are people who are not counted in our community, who are not 55, who need counting. I just want to know how, when I'm not that person, can I do better about helping that population?
So certainly. So I think you've put your finger on a couple of things. One is that, you know, for years and years, there'd been sort of this myth that, you know, MS was a disease of Northern Europeans. Well, that's a myth. You know, we have to bust that myth completely. You know, MS is present in every race, ethnicity, age as well. I mean, there's pediatric MS, there's older onset MS, there's sort of, you know, typical onset MS. Some of the work we've been doing as the National MS Society has first been to really understand, what is the distribution of race and ethnicity and who gets MS. And, you know, the data shows us clearly that, you know, Black individuals, Hispanic, Asian individuals, the, you know, Northern European communities, they all are susceptible to MS and can develop MS. We also know that very much a giant challenge is clinical trials don't recruit representative populations. They tend to recruit, you know, individuals that, you know, sort of, you know, go to the major medical centers that have many of the advantages and privileges, and that, you know, that underrepresented groups are neglected in terms of clinical trial design. And we have been pushing for much more inclusivity in clinical trials, pushing for and engaging with our partners to address the issues of health equity so that, you know, our communities that have been marginalized, that have been left behind because of some of the mythology, we need to reconcile and really address, you know, our responsibility in perpetuating a myth, but also going beyond just talking about it, but actually funding research, encouraging individuals, requiring clinical trials to have a diversity plan to ensure that it is truly representative of the disease. And then we're also going beyond that to also think about how we, you know, address issues of cultural awareness with our trainees as we train doctors and ensure that, you know, individuals, you know, are able to be treated by a doctor that looks and talks like them, which is another major issue. And I think those are all part of what I would just describe as a long-term commitment to ensure that everyone who is affected by MS can have access to the healthcare they need from a doctor or a healthcare provider that is the right healthcare provider for them. You know, this is not a one-time thing, 1 year thing or a 2 year thing. This is a long commitment by the society, and one that we are just as committed today as we were 5 years ago, and we'll be just as committed 5 years from now, because that's one, the right thing to do, but two, it speaks to why we're here, which is for all people affected by MS, regardless of where they live, who they are, what their community.
Yes, thank you. And as I learn more, I want to do more, because I feel like until we include everybody, we include no one. Everybody needs to be represented, and we're all
exactly
one. I appreciate
absolutely
the work that we're doing, you're doing collectively. And, you know, I think a lot of people with MS, they run into people, and I run into people, and I use assistive devices, but not every day. And they'll say, you have secondary progressive MS, but this person's in a wheelchair. I'm not all the time, but now I have a walking device. People also often say, how can you have secondary progressive when this person looks over here and looks differently? I think a lot of these subtypes can sometimes be, I don't want to say damaging, can lead us to interpretize the way things should be. And I want to encourage people, we all present differently. And can you extrapolate on that a little bit?
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's the power of words. You know, so when we talk about things such as relapsing MS or progressive MS, and within progressive, primary progressive, secondary progressive MS, you know, to just take your audience back, sort of how we arrived at those terms, you know, in the mid-1990s, actually, there had been a lot of confusion around how to describe MS. And so you could have one doctor telling a patient, you know, well, this is the MS that I see in you. Yet other doctors had other terms that they used. And so one of the things that the National MS Society did was to do a survey of the community, bring people together, and arrive at this consensus for, generally speaking, when you look at MS, again, in 1995, you know, this is sort of what you'd see. You'd have a group of people that have relapsing, remitting, comes and goes. Others that are going to have a more progressive form. Some of that progression is right from the beginning. That's where we get primary progressive MS from, because it's the first thing, the first experience a person has. And then we have this term, secondary progressive, which was they have progression after they've had a relapsing. And that's, you know, and that's how we arrived at that term. Those were sort of basically descriptors of the person's disease, but that was a long time ago. And, you know, biology has moved, you know, our understanding of MS has moved along. And one of the challenges of the use of those words is that they then became standards for recruiting for clinical trials, for drug approvals, for a number of things. And as you would say, is, you know, you are Jen Powell. You're not secondary progressive MS Jen Powell. You are a person living with MS.
Depends on the day.
The course of the disease is this, but, you know, what we've talked quite a bit about is how these labels are not, they're not meant to be permanent, actually. You know, it is the disease of MS is much more dynamic, but these very static terms seem to leave an impression that somehow, well, once you're secondary progressive MS, you can never be anything but secondary progressive MS. But the state of the science actually would say that's probably not true anymore. And when we talk about things like smoldering MS or progression independent of relapse activity, what we're beginning to understand is that MS is actually a much more dynamic disease, and that a person could have a relapse, and then the relapse goes away. They could progress a little bit, but then they could relapse again, and then they could progress a little less, or they get some recovery because their nervous system bounces back. And so part of the work that I'm actually doing as part of an international group is looking at these label terms like secondary progressive MS, primary progressive MS, relapsing MS, and doing two things. One is saying we need a framework for describing MS that's actually based in the biology of the disease and not simply on what did the doctor see and describe. So that's one piece. We also, you know, if we develop a new way for describing MS, there is an important consideration, which is whatever new terms we need to use actually need to make sense in the biology of the disease, They also need to make sense in her in terms of how drugs are approved. They need to make sense in terms of how payers use this terminology. I mean, as you know, right? Secondary progressive is like everywhere, and in a number of it's in the FDA approval documents. It's how payers tend to look at the world. But I think you touched on the what I think is a really important piece, which is they also get treated as though somehow it's a permanent thing tacked onto you. And we believe we've got it. One, it's not a permanent thing. And two, really find different ways of describing the disease that actually describes what's happening in you
Well
at this
put.
time and
Yeah.
not, not what happened maybe 5 years ago, if that
That's
makes
such a
sense
good
to you.
point. You also bring up an excellent point on extrapolating to insurance companies, how things are done in getting things approved with drugs, with trials. It's a
Yeah.
process. But I
It
think,
it's totally,
yeah.
yeah.
No, go ahead.
No, it totally is a process, and part of it is, understanding that word and language changes, and also science changes, and that's the part of it. The science has moved remarkably over the last 30 years, and our
Isn't that wonderful?
terms,
Goodness.
yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But our terms aren't keeping pace, and we also have to understand. This is one of the things that I talk about with clinical colleagues all the time is once a clinician tells a person this is where you are in your disease journey, right now it sort of becomes a permanent fixture, and we have to make it not such a permanent fixture.
That's well said. I think it's easier said than done because I think
Yeah.
diagnostic criteria and whatnot put us in that category. Like for a doctor to be able to get their patient an MRI, they probably have to check boxes too. But I think if
Yeah.
we look at it like the disease is a process and it's ever changing, that's powerful. Also for
That's what we're
people
aiming
to know
for.
that, so they look at themselves and maybe give themselves a little latitude and grace. Because especially with that, well, with anything, but with a progressive disease, it's just a constant state of change.
Indeed, indeed.
Tim, what inspires you to stay so dedicated to the big picture of curing MS?
Yeah, that's a great question. So first off, when I came into the MS movement, I actually started when right after the first DMT was approved. I didn't know it at the time that beta-seron in 1993 had just been approved. And I would say, in the decades since that drug was approved, what I see is how MS has just been transformed so fundamentally. Even over the last 10 years, where you had the first treatment for progressive MS, you've seen, outside of migraine, which has seen an explosion of treatments for the management of migraine, which is great. MS stands as the other example in neurology where you actually have treatments that change the trajectory of the disease. We're also seeing how the science is changing things so fundamentally. Just to give you an example, in 2001, when the first iteration of the first generation of the McDonald diagnostic criteria were introduced to diagnose MS, it took on average of 4 years for a person to go from having their first symptom to getting confirmed for their diagnosis. So it was a long time. And people from that era will tell you, yeah, it took like forever for me to get diagnosed. Today, if with the now the fourth generation of the McDonald diagnostic criteria, that is down to sometimes less than 6 months, sometimes less than 3 months. It can average sometimes a year. Now, I will say, I'm sure some of your audience will say, it still took me a long time to get diagnosed. And I agree with, we've got a number of challenges we need to solve for making the diagnosis even faster. But to go from 4 years down to months and is a big deal. And so I'm excited by how the science and the community is coming together both to diagnose MS faster. We now have treatments for it faster. And I'm also inspired by the fact that I know that we can make a difference for people in living with progressive MS today. And that, Ocrevus was a start, just like beta-seron was the start for relapsing MS. And I believe that, we can actually stop this disease before it starts and, make a difference, meaningful difference in people's lives today. So that's my sort of I've seen how much progress we've made, and I believe we can make even more progress over the next few years.
I'm emotional because if you see Tim, like I'm looking at him, you know that you're dedicated, and we're really blessed as people with MS to have you on our side. Thank you.
Thank you. I am grateful to be with you, and you're grateful for your listeners.
You're going to have to be back like 20 times to go over half the things in my head right now. So,
I am always welcome. It'd be an honor to come back on your show.
thank you. As we close, Tim, what message would you like to leave our listeners?
So I think I would offer them that, we are in a time where, we are making remarkable progress with MS. There are more treatments, more abilities to live powerfully with MS. I would also offer that, this is also a time where we need community and connection and engaging with each other more than ever before. It's the MS journey can be a challenge, and that challenge can be solved in some instances by treatments, but also by connection. And I would just ask your audience to find people that they can connect with and be part of a movement to be able to both solve MS, but also to support each other as we move through this MS journey. Because we say at the Society Together we are stronger, and I truly believe that we are stronger when we are in community together. And so at a at in the rather challenging time that we live in, finding opportunities to connect and be in community with each other is also really super important.
Thank you, Dr. Tim Quitsey. Thank you for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And links to the National MS Society and Dr. Quitsey and the Progressive MS Alliance will be in this episode's description. And to our audience at MS News Today, I am your host, Jen Powell. Thank you for joining the MS Podcast. Share your thoughts on this episode through social media. You can find MS News Today on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Follow us to keep updated on the latest news and to never miss new content and initiatives. Click the links in this episode's description.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to Multiple Sclerosis News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.multiplesclerosisnewstoday.com.